I think we're ready for the last session of the day. Thank you for staying late with us and being here to hear more about the opioid crisis and what the agency and partners are doing to combat it. I'm going to have the panel come out, and then I'll introduce Ernie on my team and have him introduce the rest. So, Ernie, would you like to take a seat, please?
Sure.
Thank you. Ernie Tai is on my team and CMS San Francisco in the Drug and Health Plan Oversight Group, Drug and Health Plan Operations Group, excuse me. He's our technical advisor and actually serves many different hats and has served many hats. Has worn many hats in the past, including as account manager. Specific for this session, I'll say that he is the our local opioid misuse ambassador and CMS San Francisco's regional opioid engagement group lead. He's been with CMS for 14 years. Prior to that, was with Blue Shield of California as senior counsel, has been policy director at the Asian and Pacific Islander American Health Forum, and director of the Network of Ethnic Physician Organizations Project at the California Medical Association Foundation. He's a graduate of Stanford, the Johns Hopkins University School of Public Health, and the University of California, Berkeley Law School. Ernie Tai.
Thank you, Ann.
So now it's my turn. I get to introduce our panelists. Starting on my near left, it's Molly Colombo. She's Director of Pharmacy Care Management and Experience at SCAN Health Plan, and she's responsible for oversight of their Part D operations, including coverage determinations and redeterminations. She also maintains the patient safety programs at SCAN, including the drug utilization programs such as opioids. She's also worked at the AIDS Healthcare Foundation, Group Health Co-op in Seattle, and looks like you did a residency at the National Alliance of State Pharmacy Associations. Next to Molly is Amit Khurana. She's currently pharmacy director for Aetna Better Health of California, and they serve the Medi-Cal population. So I wanted to say we have the sort of span of plan types here, Medicare, Medicaid, and commercial. Wanted to get the full experience for you. Amit represents the Medi-Cal managed care plans, and she's experienced, and I have to take a deep breath on this, pharmacy contract compliance, PBM oversight, fraud and abuse, legislative and state government affairs, drug utilization review, formulary management, pharmacy analytics, pharmacy quality metric reporting, pharmacy, I have to turn page here, benefit design, P&T committees, new health plan invitations, and readiness reviews. And she formerly served on the National Beneficiary Advisory Panel for the TRICARE population. And to my far left is Patrick Robinson. He's pharmacy manager for Sutter Health Plan, also known as Sutter Health Plus. He previously served at the Department of Healthcare Services and at CalPERS and at both EDS and ACS. Patrick's a former member of the Board of Trustees of the California Pharmacists Association. So I'm going to start out by providing an overview of the CMS actions to address the opioid crisis. And then we're going to have a question and answer discussion with my three panelists. And I'm hoping to take a couple of or a few questions from the audience. So in this presentation, I'm really addressing the opioid crisis as it relates to our three programs, Medicare, Medicaid, and the Marketplace. And I'm addressing this crisis because it's one of our CMS and Department of Health and Human Services' highest priorities. Also, in the interest of time, I'm not going to be reading each of the slides. You have them in your conference materials. So this slide is really the table of contents slide, so you can see what I'm going to be covering today. So what are we talking about? We're talking about opioids, legal and illicitly obtained, and I'll be focusing on the legal prescribed opioids. And if you'll indulge me for just a moment, I have an opioid experience I'd like to share. So a little over a year ago, I had shoulder surgery, rotator cuff surgery, and there were complications. I was on the table for a little bit more than 4 hours, and when I came to in the recovery room, the nurse asked me how I was doing. And I said I was in a little bit of pain. And before I could object, she said, okay, I'll give you a shot of fentanyl. And so the drug really sort of swept over me, sort of like a wave. And I was thinking, is this what addicts feel, that euphoria? In any case, my pain was gone, so that was my, and I didn't get addicted. So the that's all good for, that's my experience with opioids and particularly fentanyl. And in terms of opioids and older adults, the Medicare population, opioids can effectively treat some debilitating pain that impacts function and quality of life. And this is helpful, especially for older adults and for the older adults to remain independent. So we have to really weigh the benefits versus the risks of opioid use. And then there are the overdoses on opioids, and here are the grim statistics that we're pretty familiar with. And the deaths really, and what you think about is, oh, are these affecting a certain population or a certain class of folks? And the deaths are really not bound by class or economic status. And we saw that recently with the overdose death of Saoirse Kennedy Hill at the Kennedy Family Compound in Massachusetts. For CMS, our guiding document is the CMS roadmap called the Actions to Address the Opioid Crisis. And these are some of the steps in our CMS roadmap. Our CMS roadmap begins by describing the scope of the crisis. Again, some of the grim statistics that you can read for yourself. What struck me is that there are about 11.4 million people who misuse prescription opioids, and that 3 out of 4 folks who go on to use heroin first misuse prescription opioids. There are over 2 million people who have an opioid use disorder called OUD, but only about 20% of those folks with OUD actually get treatment. So treatment's very effective, very important for us. Again, our CMS roadmap lists the 3 key areas of our focus: prevention, which is managing pain relying less on prescription opioids, treatment, expanding access to treatment, and data, using data to target our prevention and treatment efforts and to identify fraud and abuse. And I'll be returning to these 3 key areas very soon. So we've had some successes so far, CMS has had, and we're hoping to lead by example in our 3 programs. Again, I'm not going to read the slide, but these are some of the steps we've taken already to address the crisis. And then just looking forward, by no means resting on the successes mentioned in our last slide, we continue to focus on the 3 key areas again as they relate to our 3 programs. Again, our 3 programs, Medicare, Medicaid, and the marketplaces. And again, our CMS roadmap. And the roadmap's 3 key areas of focus. Here they're listed a little bit out of order: treatment, data, and prevention. This is stepping back. Our parent agency, the Department of Health and Human Services, has also established a really comprehensive high-level strategy to address pain management and to identify the best practices around pain management. So let's talk about one of the key areas, treatment, and specifically medication-assisted treatment, or MAT. So MAT combines behavioral therapy as well as medications, and it's a quote-unquote whole-person approach, which has been proven to be successful in treating opioid use disorder. There are 3 main drugs that are used in MAT: methadone, buprenorphine, BOOP, and naltrexone. So separately or in combination, these 3 drugs normalize brain chemistry, block euphoric effects, relieve cravings, and normalize body functions. MAT is greatly underused. I mentioned the 20% figure earlier. And there are a number of reasons that we've identified for the underutilization. One is a misconception. You're just replacing one drug with another. Lack of training of providers, stigma, and discrimination. And our Medicare program has again started to take some concrete steps towards addressing the crisis. As regards Medicare's coverage of treatment, Medicare covers alcohol and drug treatment if services are from a Medicare participating provider and they're reasonable and necessary. Here's a list of some of the services that we cover. And then Medicare covers with, on the medication side, Medicare covers with some restrictions, most of the prescription drugs for drug treatment that I'd earlier described. And also, as with most of our Part D drugs, utilization management rules may apply. Again, there's always the opportunity for the patient or the prescriber to request an exception to one of our coverage rules to get the rule waived. Turning to the next key area of prevention, Part D plans may adopt drug management programs to limit an at-risk person's access to frequently abused drugs, and which includes opioids and benzodiazepines. So a person is considered at risk, quote-unquote at risk, if they use opioids for multiple prescribers and or multiple pharmacies. Plans can then are allowed to limit such at-risk person's access to frequently abused drugs to selected prescribers or selected pharmacies. It's called lock-in. And through the use of person-specific point-of-sale, that's point-of-sale at the pharmacy, claims edits. In terms of the Medicare Part D safety alerts, drug plans may send to the pharmacy an alert for review before a prescription is filled. Which are probably most have heard most about are the 7-day supplies for the opiate naive. So for first prescription fills for opioids, beneficiaries are limited to a 7-day supply of opioids or less if they haven't recently taken opioids. And then if a prescription can't be filled as written, including those over 7-day supply, the pharmacist will give the person a paid notice explaining how they or their doctor can contact the plan to ask for a coverage determination. Turning to the key area, the third key area of data, Medicare has a Part D opioid drug mapping tool, what I call the heat map. And this shows the data about Medicare opioid prescribing rates down to the state, county, and even zip code level. So it's a pretty powerful tool. Turning to our Medicaid program, which is called Medi-Cal here in California. So states have the option to cover substance use disorder, SUD is what we call it on the Medicaid side, treatment services. We're fortunate here in California in that California Medi-Cal covers SUD services through a Section 1115 waiver. Approved in 2015. We were the first in the country. And it's called the Drug Medi-Cal Organized Delivery System. It's now operating in about 40 counties. We have 58 in the state, and it's at least maybe more than 40 now. And it covers a broad continuum of SUD treatment and support services. And it covers MAT, case management, residential treatment, recovery services, withdrawal management. And on top of that, the delivery system was completely reorganized. So the at the county level, again, the 40 counties that have adopted the program, each county contracts with its providers for residents of its county. It's essentially a county-specific managed care environment, and all of the services or the full array of services are provided at the county level. And then for consistency across the county, each county has to abide by the American Society of Addiction Medicine, ASAMS, criteria for SUD care. I was talking to one of our Medicaid folks, and I asked her about the advantages of the 1115 waiver for California. And she said that it used to take about 3 to 6 months before you could get into treatment. And with the institution of this program, now takes less than a week, so less than 2 weeks, so a week to 10 days to get into treatment. So the turnaround time is very quick. On the Medicare, as in the case of Medicare, Medicaid can impose utilization management controls on prescriptions. On this particular slide, I wanted to point out the final bullet, which was the state prescription drug monitoring programs, PDMPs, here in California. We call them CURES. Data is collected from pharmacies, outpatient clinics, and others on dispensed controlled substances. On the reporting side for Medicaid, the state Medicaid agencies report annually to us, CMS, about their drug utilization review program activities. So this may involve placing quantity limits on opioids, monitoring the concurrent use of opioids and benzodiazepines, employing those PDMP requirements, and using tools that measure morphine milligram equivalents, MMEs, per year. And I understand that next year those reporting requirements are getting tightened up. And these are a list of some other opportunities that the states have to tailor their Medicaid programs to address substance use disorders. And then finally, turning to our third program, the marketplaces, also called the health insurance exchanges here in California. It's called Covered California. All marketplace plans must cover the 10 essential health benefits called EHBs. Those EHBs include coverage for mental and behavioral health services, substance use disorder benefits, and prescription drug coverage. There are also protections against excessive costs to the consumers. Just sort of stepping back, CMS has less authority over the marketplace and the marketplace plans. So at this time, we're strongly encouraging the coverage of all MAT drugs and behavioral health services by the marketplace issuers. And that, I think, does it for me. There are a lot of additional information and resources at the end of your materials and your course materials. We have a CMS.gov website with a bunch of opioid information. On this slide, I might mention that the Surgeon General, sort of the chief medical doctor in the country, has declared the opioid epidemic a public health emergency, and also has issued an advisory to carry naloxone, which can be used to reverse an opioid overdose. Again, there's hhs.gov/opioids. Our sister SAMHSA agency's website, Centers for Disease and Control's website. And that's me for this part of it. I'm going to ask our three panelists, their names are here, a couple of questions, and we're sort of going to go in turn, if that's okay, and starting with question one. What are your health plans doing in the areas of prevention, treatment, and data?
Okay, so my name's Molly, and I'm at SCAN Health Plan. We're a Medicare Advantage prescription drug plan here in California, so I'm the Medicare person. And we have a five-pronged strategy for our opioid program. It starts with formulary UM management to make sure we ensure safe prescribing. And then we do a lot of education of our providers and informing them of maybe outlier members. We try to educate and support our members. And then we want to ensure access to treatment, as Ernie said, definitely the hot spot for now. We either that's medication-assisted treatment or alternatives to pain management. And then we also are trying to partner with other organizations to make sure we raise awareness of the opioid issues. So that's our five-pronged strategy. When it comes to prevention, you know, as Ernie mentioned, CMS expects us to have some point-of-sale edits in place. We have the 7-day naive edit, and that's a hard edit. Then care coordination is a soft edit at 90 morphine milligram equivalents, or MME, from now on. And then a soft edit for concurrent opioid benzo use. A soft edit for duplicate long-acting opioid therapy, and then we have the flexibility to have a hard edit at a higher level of MME, at either 200 MME or more, and SCAN has chosen to use 240. So Looking at these edits, the most common one that fired for us in 2019 is that 7-day naive. And although it's a hard edit, Medicare did make an exception to allow pharmacies to override that at point of sale. We're very thankful for that exception because it really did reduce burden. And if a member's new to us, they look naive in our system, but the pharmacy might know that member. Or they might be able to look in cures and see that they're not naive. So the pharmacy has the ability to override that claim. And we wanted to see how they got resolved at point of sale. So we looked at our data, and about 66% of the time, that claim we see a paid claim adjusted to that 7-day supply. So that's good. 66% of the time, it's doing what it should do. And then 17% of the time, it's overridden either at point of sale by the pharmacy or through the coverage determination process. That's an option. And for a day supply more than 7 days, so maybe the physician warranted it. And then 70% of the time, we did not see a subsequent paid claim. So we're not sure what happened to those. Maybe they paid out of pocket. But looking at the point of sale edits in general, they are very effective. We saw a 41% decrease in the proportion of members who are naive and getting a day supply more than 7 days. So that one was very effective. And then 18% of a decrease for doses over 90 MME, and similarly for benzo opioid, about 18% decrease. So we felt like those are really effective for prevention. Looking at treatment, it's a major focus for us. We do struggle with getting patients with opioid use disorder assigned to or connected to MAT. And we don't have any formulary restrictions on our MAT drugs. And then we try to keep them at lower tiers so they're affordable. And then we use our care management program at SCAN. So we look at the at-risk or potentially at-risk members. And we review them and try to see if they're ready for treatment. And then if they are, we really want to coordinate that. And like you guys know, here in California with the delegated model, it has its challenges because we are trying to connect them to the medical group and we don't always know who they use for MAT. So we did a class with our provider groups in our area to help them obtain the waivers if they want to do that for prescribing, because you need that waiver for buprenorphine. And then we also pulled information from SAMHSA, and we have an internal repository, so we know who in our network at least has that waiver for buprenorphine, and that's helped us a lot because it wasn't as obvious to us where to go for that treatment, because the one that's treating their pain isn't necessarily the one who can provide the MAT, which is one of our challenges. Ernie talked a little bit about the lock-in protocol, and our drug management program has that protocol available, but we have not had to use it this year. We've been able to manage our members through just hard touch case management, so we're kind of glad we didn't have to lock them in. And then the other thing, did you mention the OTPs?
Not yet.
Okay. So there's going to be opioid treatment program coverage under Part B. And at SCAN, it's kind of funny. You hear opioids and it's like pharmacy benefit. But this is a Part B benefit. So we're working internally with our medical side to make sure we're coordinated for the OTP benefit. And that's going to be interesting because we anticipate a learning curve there. Then when it comes to data, we have our internal key performance indicators, and that obviously that's going to look at utilization, but some of the ones that we thought we would mention today is we do look at the percent of high-risk members who are prescribed naloxone, and we've seen an increase there in the past couple of years of about 15%, primarily because of the law that you've for co-prescribing, but at least we're seeing that co-prescribing happening. The other KPI that we look at is percent initial fill over 7 days for acute use, and we adopted that from AHIP. And AHIP is pretty great because they post some data, so at least you can get a frame of reference for how you're doing, not necessarily Medicare to Medicare, just kind of overall. So we like to use their measures so we can do some apples-to-apples comparison. Then Medicare sends us some reports that are helpful through the overutilization monitoring system. It's abbreviated OMS. And that's a retrospective look at members with lots of prescribers and or pharmacies. And then we additionally pull some internal reports that identify also members with multiple prescribers on multiple opioids and an ER visit for pain. And so with those two reports, we put them into our case management and then filter out where our at-risk members are. So it's really good for us to identify them. And then lastly, we get some HPMS reports. HPMS is the health plan management system. And they give us a report of C2 prescribers. It's not always, so we get these prescribers, we'll just look and see if we have any scan claims. A lot of times we don't. It's just in their database, they see them as high prescribers, and then we just tease them up with our members. SIU looks through that list as well. That's the fraud, waste, and abuse component. And then they send us the pharmacy risk assessment as well through HPMS. So a lot of what we leverage is CMS help, so we appreciate that. So those are my 2 cents, and I'll turn it over to Emmett for Medicaid.
Thanks, Molly. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Emmett Corona. I'm with the Medi-Cal Health Plan, Aetna Better Health of California. And as a Medicaid health plan, we face several issues along with the opioid use. So we see members who are facing homelessness, food insecurities, mental health issues, and may require greater PCP coordination along with case management. So with that population, sometimes it's difficult to determine which of these needs to be addressed first, and how can we achieve the environment and the support structure so that we can address the substance use or the opioid use. So we need a member-centric, evidence-based approach to addressing the opioid use that's mindful of our members' environment as well. In terms of prevention, then, the idea is really to A, reduce the supply of unnecessary opioids, and B, to decrease the overdose and the abuse. So remember, as Ernie said in one of his slides, 130 Americans die every day of an opioid overdose. That's pretty staggering. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, 1 in 10 Americans experience chronic pain. So we have two different opportunities here, priority areas that we need to address. And so what we do is we basically try to start with preventing new starts. So how can we decrease or encourage non-opioid use for chronic pain? So we will prefer those drugs that are non-opioids on our preferred drug list, on the formulary, and make it easier for providers to have access to prescribing non-opioids. And then the 7-day limit, we have that as well, where if we have, we limit them to 7-day supply of opioids, and that's after an acute procedure, okay? As well as the quantity limits that Ernie also mentioned, some of those UM edits. We have the quantity limits that match the CDC recommendation of the 90 MME, or morphine milligram equivalents. So those are some of the steps in terms of utilization management. But when you really think about it, 90 MME is pretty high because, and I'm quoting from CDC, if you go above 50 MME, you're doubling the risk of overdose. So we really try to stay between the 50 and the 90 if possible. And we have real-time point-of-sale alerts at the pharmacy. And there'll be soft alerts or there'll be hard alerts. So a soft alert would be like a message that pops up for the pharmacist versus a hard alert where the pharmacist is required to do something. There's an action that's required in order for them to bypass that alert. So for something like a 50 MME, the system will calculate, oh, this member is getting a 50 MME supply of opioids. a message will pop up that says, you may want to consider prescribing naloxone for this member. And that's a message to the pharmacist. And in California, we're lucky enough that we have this, where our pharmacists can actually prescribe and dispense naloxone either to the patient or even to caregivers. So we're very, we can utilize that to funnel those types of members and get them that opportunity taken care of there at point of sale. So we also have other step and UM edits, well, not step, sorry, just UM edits, that is quantity limits. So we have the quantity limits, we have the PAs, so prior authorization on all long-acting opioids. So all long-acting opioids, even though they require prior authorization, we have something along with that that is called a smart PA, where the system, so it's integrated, and the system will look for a diagnosis code of, say cancer or palliative care. If they can see that in the system, if the system can see that, then it'll automatically bypass that prior authorization requirement. So we are not restricting access to those members that need the drugs as well. So at the same time, we're trying to balance that. And then to decrease the rate of overdose, which is that second part of the imperative, we have prior authorization criteria that looks at prior opioid use, that looks at any prior overdoses. That's the criteria that is evaluated, and make sure that the provider has access to the PDMP as well. So, and in terms of treatment, we actually don't have much that we can do in terms of directly impacting treatment because it is carved out to the state, and under that 115 waiver that Ernie has mentioned, or 1115, sorry, waiver that Ernie mentioned, it is carved out to the state. What we can do is encourage, like I said, the messaging to the pharmacist to prescribe naloxone, or we can evaluate and look for those members that require our high-risk members and get them into case management, get them over to the services that the state has, and get them connected with those services. And we can support that by providing the transportation needs or any other needs that are necessary for the member. And in terms of data, we can use data in several different ways. One is, of course, to have an analysis that measures performance and compare it to pre-established goals. For example, are we decreasing the MME per day for members based on a certain intervention that we did? So performance measures, that's how we can, one way, use data. Another way is to, like Molly said as well, to look for high-utilizing prescribers. And prescribers that are, say, prescribing a lot of opioids over 150 MMEs for members with no cancer diagnosis or palliative care, and then target them for the provider education. I think the previous fraud, waste, and abuse in Ms. Brady, she was talking about a provider mission. And so this is very similar to that, where you're actually education mission, where you're actually educating those providers. So you can use data to identify them. And then algorithms that identify members using who are using multiple providers, multiple pharmacies, and looking at that for case management and safety and monitoring programs, so that we can make sure we follow through with those members and they don't fall through any cracks as well. So those are some of the some of the ways that we in Medi-Cal can affect the treatment and prevention and data as well. I'll turn it over to Patrick.
Thank you. Patrick Alwin Sutter. Pleasure to be here. Sutter is a local Northern California hospital provider closed system organization. And 6 years ago, they started a health plan, Sutter Health Plus. The reason that's important is because it offers us the ability to use tools really at some optimal levels. So what are we doing? I'm going to approach it twice, two ways, one in ambulatory and one at the pharmacy. So what is Sutter doing at the ambulatory level? Well, we've started an opiate stewardship committee, similar to your antibiotic awareness committee. So it's a committee that's responsibility to, are we appropriately prescribing and taking care of our patients and our members with pain medication. And then we have a lot of tools on our electronic health record. And I want to name a few of them off because when I think about it, it's kind of impressive. So in the at the point of care, in the electronic health record, you when you order a opioid or a controlled substance, it will automatically calculate the morphine equivalent dose for you, let you know where you're at, give you guidelines if you should do anything. It will automatically take you out to CURES, the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program for the state of California, to see if there's other prescriptions being filled at other places. There are contracts with members for pain and narcotic use. They're standard contracts, and it gives expectations, sets expectations to the member, to the patient, on what's expected with pain medication and what their role is. We have referrals in and out that we can do from our electronic health record. We have medication reconciliation. So in an electronic health record, you're sending prescriptions out to pharmacies. You don't know if they're ever picked up. Well, you can run a program that tells you that there are dispensed medications. So you've written one, and a dispensed medication from a pharmacy comes back into the electronic health record, and you can reconcile that. Is that what I requested, or are there other prescriptions that I didn't know about? Are they in there? We have also, it's Care Everywhere, which is Epic's system, that you can talk to other electronic health records, and if a member's been seen at those other places, you can see what kind of care they're being taken care of and coordinate that care. And in our electronic health record, we have guidelines for treating pain, whether it's acute, whether it's from surgery, and whether it's a kid. So your guidelines are right there at the point of care to guide you to make sure that everything is appropriate. Now, if you go onto the pharmacy side, yeah, we have all those standard edits. Yeah, you can override them with soft edits or hard edits. But the other thing that we've done at the health plan is at our mail order facility, we require a disposable bag for every controlled substance to be mailed with them. So when a prescription comes in, a patient gets either morphine or maybe even Adderall, they get a bag to dispose of it properly if they do not have to use any more of it. So that takes it out of the system and away from other people potential abuse. Reporting. So we have the standard reporting, you know, too many prescribers, too many pharmacies. We look at it. Well, how are we doing? How is Sutter doing in 2019? We looked at our reports, and we can't even come up with 100 high alert reports. And of the ones that we come up with, we really haven't seen any issues. So as a system, we know the problems out there for prevention. We're addressing it. We have a long ways to go, but we feel like in our closed system, we are doing a fairly good job. Then I go to treatment. Treatment's a different bird, right? We're talking about chronic lifetime treatment. So what does that tell us? That tells us we have decades of work in front of us, right? We've got a lot of people out there are going to need help for decades, for their entire life. So what is the, in my mind, the crux there, and that's the coordination of care. And it's not easy to coordinate because you have different players, PCP, psychologists, psychiatrists, dietitians, facilities, acute hospital settings. And it's tough to make sure that everybody's talking to everybody, everybody's on the same page for this individual. And even the individual has to be on the same page, right? They might come and go on that page. But we have to be coordinated. So I see that as a crux and an opportunity in the future for us to be better. And Sutter is closed, but we can't take care of all of our members in Northern California with just the Sutter facilities and the Sutter docs. So we have to have other partners. And there it gets a little bit tricky. Who's going to be injecting some of this medication? Where do they get it from? Whose financial responsibility is it? So data. How does Sutter approach data? Well, we approach it as a population management, right? Population management is our coordinating hub. We have all the data in our electronic health record. We have claims data. We have other data that we can get. And that is where we say, okay, we're coordinating. So what are we coordinating? We're coordinating the care of an individual for their life, whether it's acute care, where it's operations, senior care, whether it's social, family benefits. So that's where our approach now. We're hoping that this population management will get us so that we can coordinate that care across all of our members. Okay, Ernie, back to you.
So I'm wondering if there are any questions for our panelists. It sounds like everybody has taken a somewhat similar approach to prevention and treatment, but we do have some follow-up questions that I'd like to ask, but are there any questions or requests for clarification? I know there's some acronyms that we had thrown around. The mic is roving in the back.
Go ahead and just raise your hand, and we'll bring a mic to you. Can ask your question if you have one. Please tell us your name and organization.
I'm Jane Balg from Stanford Healthcare. Is this unique to America, or are there other countries in the other developed countries have the same issue?
Yeah, I'm not sure if I can speak for all other countries. The opioid crisis is more acute, if I can call it that, here in the States. And it's just the way I think our healthcare delivery system and what we've been seeing with the manufacturers and the sales detail folks sort of pushing the opioids over decades that sort of come to a head with what we're seeing with the crisis and epidemic today.
I think you nailed it. Is, you know, I hate to accuse anybody, but in our society, it's easier to take a drug than, you know, go be healthy and exercise. And we kind of hit onto that with some of the new opioids that came out, OxyContin. The manufacturer of OxyContin convinced many prescribers that it was a safe drug, that there were no issues to worry about. And we bought into it as a society. We all bought into it. And that kind of started the snowball. And it's only been the last few years where we realized that was our thinking was not right.
Thank you.
Any additional questions?
So my next question for the panelists was really what more can you see your health plan doing in the future? I mean, Molly mentioned the OMS and C2 data that we provide her health plan that is really actionable data. And I guess I would also ask if, you know, what more can CMS do to support the health plans in addressing this crisis?
Well, we had the advantage of meeting with OIG and Medic and Medicare last August, and I think what we found from that is Medicare has their fee-for-service data. And that was very revolutionary to say, oh, this physician is billing $4 million because they're billing on the medical side for services that like, you know, oh, we're going to do a back pain shot or, you know, certain services that we don't compile in our data because we only have scan data. And so sometimes there's data available that we just don't have access to that Medicare has. It came up with the transplant data, right? They've gotten much better at exposing a lot of the transplant data to the plans, and I think that it would help see the bigger picture the more data plans have access to. But I think we also have enough to do now with the data we have. So, you know, with the OTPs, we're going to be trying to figure that out and get patients' care through those facilities, and then just trying to have the resources to touch more members to be more helpful, because as Patrick said, the member has to be kind of on board and making sure we're talking to them when they're ready. Maybe we need to make sure our websites are really easy to use so that if they just had that night where they felt inspired, they can get the information they need without too much energy. Little things like that to make it easy, but...
So just a clarification, OTPs are opioid treatment programs, and they're current provider types, essentially, treatment programs that SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Agency, have certified. Medicare Part B will cover services, OTP services, starting January 1st. But on the Part B side, and you'd mentioned the Part D,
yeah, no, they keep calling us. Like,
So, Patrick or Amit?
Well, I'll just say that usually, in terms of change, it's more driven by policy than what we can do ourselves. But there is certain things where I think we can have an effect on. And being now that Aetna is combined with CVS, we have committed to $100 million, as John Gorman had said in his presentation yesterday. Had pointed out, to addressing the social determinants of health. Mm-hmm. And so, as we know, substance use is very closely related to the homelessness and the and food insecurities and mental health issues and those factors. So I think going forward, working with our community-based organizations to be effective locally, mm-hmm. and affecting one member, one family unit, and one community at a time to really achieve and be successful. And as Patrick said, it's a long-term process to fix this. But I think this is where we can really have a great impact, as we know how important it is to treat the entire member in a holistic way. So that's one of the future for us.
I have three things that I had thought about when I was asked this question, and they're really considerations. And I'm not sure if you as a group can do it, but I think with Ernie, we have some potential here. But I asked myself, why don't we have a national prescription drug monitoring program? Why is it state only? I know there's financial reasons for that. Years ago, I heard it. It was funding from each state that had to come up with it. But here we are in a crisis, and we still have state-only PMPDs. I don't understand it. It's a consideration. Why do you have to have a special DEA number for MAT treatment?
Right.
Is that really a benefit? Are you saving anything by making a provider go through extra hoops to be able to treat somebody, to show that you're respectful of these drugs? I think that should be reconsidered. Is the benefit much more than the risk? From my perspective, I don't understand it. Should be considered. And then policy. Healthcare is local. I see that at my local area in Northern California that really we're on board with prevention. We're going to have struggle with treatment. So I would ask that policymakers set minimum policies and that allow flexibility for the local needs. It's tough to dictate specific edits when maybe you don't need that edit. I'll give you an example. We switched to a new pharmacy benefit manager, and they came in with a powerful opiate program. Say there are like 50 of them. And we said, well, you know, our experience at Sutter is that we don't need 50. Can we just have like 3 or 4? And so we cut them back because we're local. We have a handle on what we're doing. And so I would ask that policy just respect and offer flexibility.
I'd like to add to something.
Please.
That in terms of when you say policy, another thing that came to mind when you said being flexible and local to the area is the idea of pharmacists and RNs practicing at the top of their license. So being able to, especially when we have PCPs who are in short supply right now, to be able to fill in those gaps. And an example would be the naloxone dispensing and prescribing, which for California happened. And if it's carried over to other states, something like that would, I think, would be very effective to allow those gaps to be filled in when PCPs are in short supply.
And so we're asking for questions from you, the audience. I had sure the two basic questions for our panelists, but they're just wondering if there are thoughts or even comments from the audience. Somebody up front here? Okay.
That way it's in the recording and everybody can hear it. Can you tell us your name and organization?
Thank you. Linda Griffin, Anthem Blue Cross. I'm going to say from working hospital for years and years, and then out in this area at health plan, I think one of the main starts of the opioid crisis was people with back pain and back issues. And then having to go through that myself personally. Mm-hmm. The only thing that worked until I had surgery was OxyContin, mm-hmm. and it actually took the pain away. But being a nurse, I was very, worried, and I was very conservative on what I took. But I required surgery. But I know what the other health plans and my health plan, what they allow for to have surgery. It's very conservative. And when you work in the hospital, you've had a lot of people that come in with back pain. It's a very subjective thing. If you don't see something on, special studies. So my question is, do you know of what maybe out there in the medical field? That's, I think, one of the things that we really need is something else to help people or radically help them without having to go to the physical surgery. Do you know if there's something on the horizon or the doctors at CMS, are you looking at that aspect?
So one immediate thing that Medicare is doing is we're promoting alternatives to using opioids for pain relief, and specific to back pain, we have a pilot program which covers acupuncture specifically for back pain. To me, in terms of looking at the future, Medicare is taking sort of two small incremental steps, and they should open up sort of the floodgates to sort of alternatives. But I'll let my pharmacy compatriots.
We've started interviewing some of our members that basically live with daily pain, and it's really interesting to hear what they say because they don't want to be on the drugs, they don't want a chiropractor, they like the massage, but it's like having several options available, non-opioid, non-surgery options, and finding those and having them available in the benefit. And so we're still working with our benefit has some supplemental services like that, like the massage, but I don't know if it's as diverse. So as we evolve our plans, I think we're trying to listen to members who want somewhere to go. And you're right. I mean, the options are in the data. Evidence-based options is one thing. Options that work for people sometimes another. But it's like, are they coverable? It's a tricky balance.
Yeah, I think that's where the future is, that alternative treatments be available. So even physical therapy. So I know that some plans will cover a certain number of physical therapy appointments, but I think we need to open that up a little bit more as well as acupuncture. And some members find that very effective for chronic pain. Massage therapy, like you said. But those are the non-opioid options that to prevent new starts. But those that are already on there, we have to also work on the treatment side with being able to help them with buprenorphine and Suboxone because that actually works for pain as well. And to actually encourage use there if needed. And I know there's a whole program around that in California where that's being encouraged as well.
Treatment is an individual basis. You can't say one thing is going to help everybody. So we just have to have options. We have to have evidence-based options. We are developing more evidence-based options now that the drug has caused an issue. I think that's good. And even surgery is an option. I don't know why, at some point that's really where you go. I will put a disclaimer out there. My son's an orthopedic surgeon. So it's really individual. We're going to get more information. It's tough to answer that question for you. It's really you as an individual work with your PCP, working with your team.
They don't do surgery pretty much in health plans unless you have a ruptured disc that they actually such an emergency that they have to do that. That's where I'm wondering, what is the medical arena doing so that we can phase out everything that we're talking about here, the people that are addicted and won't be,
yes, surgery is not the option for everybody, but the restrictions on how to get the surgery are so high. Like I said, you almost have to have, there's people, when you're talking about subjective pain, subjectiveness of it, that maybe only have a nerve that slightly has an issue, you know, being pressed, but somebody else might have something that's close to a rupture. You know, they measure, it's got to be at a certain millimeter, you know, of bulging or anything like that. So everybody's pain tolerance is very different. Yes. But until they get something medically to help those people, I think we're still going to have a major thing across the country. There's a lot of people that never get their, that never are able to have anything done with their back pain, and they will remain addicted. Because these other measures, I agree with you, that they're good, mm-hmm. but it's not going to help. If you still have the pain, as a very smart doctor told me a long time ago, you can't treat just the symptom. You've got to go to the heart of whatever that matter is. That's the only way that you're going to wipe it out.
Okay, I'll turn it back to Mike and Ann to close this out.